Because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. Hey, coach. Before we start the podcast, just wanted to let you know, on May 8th to 10th, I will be partnering with NBA shooting coach Dave Love to put on an exclusive basketball coaching retreat we are calling the Art of Coaching Retreat. In this limited enrollment retreat, Dave and I will share proven concepts that helped us both stimulate coaches from around the world. We will make this experience beneficial for coaches of all levels. The event will be held in beautiful, warm Palm Desert, California, Friday, May 8th to Sunday, May 10th. Go to basketball-retreat.eventbrite.com to get more information, or DM me on Twitter or Instagram, and I will send you the link. Enjoy the podcast. Coaches, real treat today to have WNBA head coach Mike Tebow with us, and really no introduction needed, coach. I mean, I believe that's the level the WNBA has got, at least for the coaches that we'll speak to on this podcast, is that they know of your success. They know you just won the WNBA championship, and we're going to dive deep into those concepts. But first off, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate it. This will be fun.
Well, coach, I mean, incredible coaching journey, and we're just talking quickly off air that you coached with the Lakers back when they won NBA championships, you know, the transition from Westhead to Riley, and then with the Bulls, and you started your career a little bit in the NBA before you went off. But can you talk just a little bit about your early experiences in the NBA?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. When I came to the Lakers full-time, I was 29 years old, and I believe I was the youngest assistant in the NBA. I had scouted part-time for them in the late 70s. I was an assistant coach in college up in Lacey, Washington, St. Martin's College, which is a D2 school up there. And conveniently, we were located right between Portland and Seattle. So it used to be that East Coast NBA teams, when they came west, would kind of go Seattle, Portland, Golden State, LA. And so the Lakers sent me to scout opponents coming in, and that was, became my kind of inroads. I had been friends with Jack McCloskey and Stan Albeck, who were Jerry West's assistants, and got to know Jerry. And so did the scouting. And then when Jack McKinney came in and brought Paul Westhead as assistant, I didn't even know if I'd continue to do it, but met with Coach Westhead and continued to do some of their advanced scouting. And then because of Coach McKinney's unfortunate bicycle accident, Coach Westhead took over, and I did all of their West Coast scouting in preparation for the 80 championship, and then went full-time as an assistant. So I was very fortunate a little bit to be in the right spot and be prepared, and I guess did a good enough job that they liked me.
Well, and a great segue, because you were part of that historical era, and now you're part of this historical era, which is the first WNBA championship for the Washington Mystics. But even more so than that, I'm not sure how much coaches are aware of the dominance that you guys put forward on offense. And I believe your offensive rating, if I have the numbers correct, was 115, and the next best was like 98. And that is the biggest difference.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's incredible, coach. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, it was a process of us getting to that. You kind of learn your lessons along the way a little bit the hard way sometimes. I've always believed that you start with offensive players over defensive players. And I know when I was a young coach, I probably thought differently because, you know, you think, you know, you want toughness and everything else. But at this level, and I think the college level too, you can take a good offensive player and get them to play pretty good defense, but it's very hard take a, you know, a defense first player who doesn't have great offensive skills and have them become great offensive players. I think, you know, that's a little bit of a pipe dream for coaches. And so, you know, I think our final lesson in all this was in the finals the year before. Obviously, you know, Elena had been hurt, but we were missing Emma Mieseman. We're playing Seattle, and every time Seattle substituted, they substituted another player in who could shoot the ball. And we were usually having four players on the court that could really shoot it, but we were a little bit shorthanded. Our fifth player, you know, was those kind of players were good players. They were great teammates. They did all the right things defensively, but Seattle ignored them on the offensive end in the sense that, you know, you could cheat a little bit. And I think the final step for us was making a few adjustments in the offseason last year. obviously getting Emma Mieseman back, who is one of the most efficient offensive players in the game. And we were able to do what Seattle had done to us, to everybody we played this year. We could always have scorers on the floor. And then you have to have unselfish players. And so in the course of my 7 years here, we had, you know, year by year tried to add people that fit the mold of that kind of player. Can score, can shoot, unselfish, puts team first. And we finally got the final product.
Well, and it was a great final product. I mean, just tremendous games throughout the finals. Well, it's really throughout. I mean, when I went back on Synergy as I was preparing for this and watching your team, I mean, just really enjoyable basketball to watch. And I think what people don't realize is that a lot of WNBA teams were ahead of NBA teams in terms of the percentage of three-point shots, it seems, until the three-point line was moved back in 2013. But now you are the one outlier, right? You're the outlier that took this to the next level for the WNBA.
Yeah, and I think we were headed that way. You just have to have enough people that can actually do it and have faith in it. I think a couple things happened. And, you know, to be clear, if we were to, you know, we shot 25 or 6 threes per game. If you put that into NBA minutes, it's roughly 30, 31, which would just put us in the middle of the pack of the NBA right now. But we're way ahead of, you know, attempts in our league. And I think that's a product of early on drafting and acquiring post players who could stretch the floor. And yet I still think the WNBA has more good low post players than the NBA does, but they're multidimensional. But for us and for Seattle the year before, we weren't going to have a Brittany Griner or Sylvia Fowles, so we had to do it a different way. So now you have the players like Elena Delladon and Breonna Stewart and, you know, Natasha Howard in Seattle and Emma Mieseman for us, who, you know, can post up and stretch the floor. And, you know, when you can do that to the teams, it really puts pressure on the defense to pick their poison. We could literally, if we wanted to, stand all five players behind the three and figure out which matchup we wanted to get with a pick and roll or a penetration and make people pay for it a little bit. But you had to be able to also put your post players on the block some, and they were good enough that they forced double teams. And now you got the same 3-point shots, but from a different way. You have to have penetrators who can, you know, get the ball to the paint. You know, we talk about paint touches. They don't have to be post ups. They don't necessarily have to be layups, but you have to get the ball to the paint to collapse defenses in order to get what we wanted on the perimeter. And so, you know, that became a huge staple of what we did. And yet I think we have a long ways to go. I mean, there's NBA teams shooting 43s a night. So, you know, we're not quite there yet.
So this is so important for coaches, because there's so many coaches that know the analytics. There's so many coaches that are thinking this way. But in reality, it's not as easy as just, let's just shoot more threes, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, A, you have to have shooters. I mean, and the literally shooters who, you know, are comfortable no matter what you do. They can step into it. We shoot a ton of shots on the move. But we also use the NBA line as our kind of guiding point. In all of our offseason work the last 2 years, we had our players shoot behind the NBA three for many reasons. Number one, so that they're not thinking about our line, they're not worried about their foot being on the line, that they're comfortable taking shots much deeper than, you know, the line, that it creates spacing for post-ups. It really improved our players' concept of what good spacing was, which allows better post entry passes, better driving lanes, longer runs by defensive players to close out to shooters. And so that was a big part of it. So, you know, it was trading for, acquiring in the draft players who can shoot and letting them understand that, you know, we were going to allow shots that maybe they hadn't been allowed before. I don't yell at players too much for shooting the ball. I don't know that I've ever taken a player out for missing what I would call an open shot. I've taken them out for passing them up and, you know, for defensive mistakes. So that's a mindset change for some players when they come from certain college systems or other pro systems.
Well, speaking to that, do you have a process for evaluating shot selection independent of outcome then? Because that seems to be such a valuable part of this.
Yes, it does. I mean, we chart everything about whether it's A, contested or uncontested. Did it come off of our normal stuff? That, you know, did it come from a paint touch? Did it come from a post up? Where did it come in the shot block? you know, did we pass up a better shot to get a tougher shot? You know, we go through all of those. I couldn't tell you all the different, you know, things that we apply to it, but yes, we evaluate every shot, you know, and sometimes, you know, the game is really actually pretty simple. I mean, when it was invented, the idea was to put the ball through the basket. And I think coaches and media and fans and everybody else, we make the game more complicated than it is. And so you have an open shot that you practice and you take. That should be a shot to take. But we are conscious about things like a two-point shot that could have been a three. You know, long twos, you know, that everybody talks about. We talk to our players about that. A foot on the line shot is a terrible shot for us. If you were that far back, you should have been able to get all the way behind the three-point line. We still emphasize getting to the basket, getting in the lane, getting layups, getting to the free throw line. Those three things are important to us. The year before, I don't think we were as good at getting to the basket, getting to the rim. We probably need to get fouled more, but we're such a great foul shooting team that nobody wants to touch us either. You know, we've set records for both the NBA and the WNBA for being an 87% free throw shooting as a team, and that's almost unheard of.
That's remarkable. And you talked about the long twos. How do you teach that out of them, so to speak? Is it you show edits, video, obviously emphasis within practice, but what are some other things that have been successful?
I mean, sometimes in training camp, we don't count that basket. If you shoot that long two in practice, even if it goes in training camp, we don't count it. Or we give it less value. We'll give it 1 point. We'll give, you know, the three, you know, a bigger value. We'll give more value to the shot that's made inside the lane in the 5 foot, 6 foot area. And we don't give value to that long two. It's just a way to get the mental mindset of it changed. And there are players that are exceptions to that. One of my assistant coaches, Ace Jones, who played for me in Connecticut, was the most efficient two-point shooter I had coached. And a player like her, we would allow to take that shot. You're not going to tell them not to because they shot it at such a high percentage that it equated into today's analytics. But those players who think that a 40-something percent two-point shot on the perimeter is a good shot, it isn't compared to everything else.
No, it's such a great point. It's not necessarily all or nothing, and part of that goes with that. Coach, maybe one discussion I had with an NBA assistant coach, they talked about some of the most efficient threes, and one of the ones that surprised me, and maybe you have some ones like this, was a pick and pop, but not pick and pop to be able to shoot the three, but pick and pop to be able to drive it, as you said, get a paint touch, and then that leads to a kick out, that they found that was one of their most efficient threes that was from an action. Do you have some examples of that for us that might highlight some of the ways you get them?
Yeah, I mean, that would be one of them for us. We have a lot of pick and roll situations where I'll give you an example with our personnel. So Natasha Cloud, who is of all of our shooters, not the best 3-point shooter, will allow her to run pick and pops with an Elena Deladon or, you know, Emma Mieseman, where we know teams are going to switch and we know that they're going to stay home with the person that actually set the screen. So if Elena Deladon sets the pick and pop, teams are going to switch it and face guard her. But now Natasha Cloud can drive the lane against the post player. Somebody's going to come to help. And now we'll get the second 3-point shooter open, whether it's Christy Tolliver or Ariel Atkins or Emma Mieseman on the other side of the floor. That because they've taken away the first one from us, that it actually gives us a chance to get the second one if we're patient.
Yeah, it's a great point to be able to understand kind of that process. And you talked about freedom and emphasis in terms of two things that lead to obviously more 3-point shots. But can you talk a little bit about system? How has this impacted your play selection or your transition spacing or different things like that? What are the technical changes that have happened within your system?
Boy, changes. I you know, this has kind of been what we've wanted for a while. We're just getting better at it. But we've always believed in if one post player is ahead of the pack, that they should go ahead and run to the block early because we have good post-up players. And that draws defenders in transition back to the lane. And we'll have our second post player, who's the trailer, now trailing into a 3-point spot because theirs is trying to help back in the paint. So that'd be the first thing. You're trying to get your wings to run really wide, sometimes foul line extended, sometimes to the deep corner. but also having to understand that there are times to make the cut to get a layup in transition, whether it's 3-on-2, 2-on-1. You know, you don't have a lot of those kind of plays, even though teams practice a lot of 2-on-1 and 3-on-2. If you play against enough good teams who play good transition defense, you're not going to get a ton of those. You're going to get those off of turnovers, you know, a steal. You're going to get a layup that way. But your other ones, you're going to get 4-on-3 or 5-on-4. And how can you get quick advantages? So we'll tell that first post player up the floor, if you're way ahead, keep running. If you're running even with the ball, now it's time to set one, what we call a drag screen in transition, and try to scramble the D on the run. You see more and more in the NBA and in our league, what's called double drags, two post players setting screen, one rolling, one popping, because you can go after defenders and make post players, defensive players, have to make decisions on the run. And that's an uncomfortable situation. If I'm guarding Emma Mieselman and she's running full speed and setting a ball screen, you know, am I switching? Am I helping? Am I trapping? Am I hedging? What am I doing? And is my person going to be covered by one of my teammates? So getting those early in the shot clock are really big and important to us.
Yeah, great examples there, Coach. Appreciate you sharing that. And you mentioned a little bit the cutting, and that's the other part of this that I think has brought value to many teams, is just the spacing creates many more opportunities for off the ball cutting, especially off a ball screen or second cut actions. And is that something that you're teaching within each play, that you're presenting opportunities for them to cut, or is this something that you're developing more organically as in they have these options?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, I think you have some structured ones where, you know, we know how teams will play it, so here's a cut we can make. But I think a lot of it is when you play in practice. We try to have sessions in practice where we call no plays. And whether it's 4-on-4, 5-on-5, we try to do it and let them start to learn early in the season how to read off each other. You know, how's the defense going to play us? We're very fortunate here to have a really good male practice squad, several of whom are guys that work as workout coaches for the Wizards. And so they're smart and they can talk and change up things, and they can help us kind of coach our players through some things. But, you know, we'll try to, you know, have our guys put us, you know, we'll tell them today, hey, here's how we want you to play the pick and rolls. We want you on this one player to trap, another one to switch, and make our players have to read it. And then we'll drill for those things. We'll work on guard penetration. Is there a cut available, or is it a spacing play? And, you know, get your players to understand, how did my man help? You know, one of the things, you know, you hear young players say a lot, hey, I was open, she didn't find me. There's a difference between being open and being seen. You know, did you move, even though you were open, did you move to the best spot where your teammate could see you, whether it's a cut or a slide or whatever it is? And that's part of becoming a good off-the-ball offensive player.
What a great point that is, for sure. Big difference between being seen and everything that goes with that. So, Coach, the other part that goes with this, as you mentioned already, is you've got to recruit players, or you've got to get players that can shoot. But what I'm curious about is, how has this system over the past bunch of years, as you move towards it, impacted your player development philosophy? Is it just a case of shooting more threes, or what are some other things that are built into player development because you want to emphasize shooting more threes?
Boy, that's a multifaceted answer there. I think that I'll try to make this as simple as I can. So, A, yes, we do shoot more threes. It's where we shoot them from. We shoot more shots, whether they're threes or anything else, that have a hand in their face at times. So we take our coaches or workout players or even players against each other, right? Here's ones where you're going to swing the ball and you're going to get a wide open look, right? The next time you're going to have somebody running at you, closing out hard, what's your decision making? Are you sidestepping to get a three? Are you attacking the rim for another draw and kick for a teammate or a layup? And so if you're constantly watching our players, you're seeing them on all sorts of different spots on the floor, on all sorts of different situations, against closeouts, against hedges, against any kind of defense that we think we'll see. We'll put ourselves into 1-on-0 or 2-on-0 or 2-on-2, 3-on-3 drills that incorporate all those defensive looks. I think part of it is also because of the way the game is going. because of the switching, you have to spend a lot more time on what's the best decision, you know, against the switch. For years, everybody, every coach in America, you saw a switch, we got to get the post mismatch. Well, sometimes that's not your best place. Sometimes your guard can attack the post on a switch much easier than you can get the ball to the big in the lane. And even if you do on a mismatch, teams are going to double team you. So, you know, we work on, all right, switch, here's your options. All right, let's say we get the post up mismatch. All right, now there's going to be a double team coming. So who should cut? Who should slide behind? That's a lot of our day-to-day work, 3-on-3, 4-on-4 in our development. A lot of our development work is learning different finishes at the rim, whether it's off a Euro step, off of the wrong foot shot, little bank shots, floaters, because you see every kind of defense. So now that's a big part of our offensive individual work, is learning different ways to finish at the rim, to take contact, to, you know, get it over bigger defenders, to learn to do those things. So every day we're doing a new assessment of where we are, and it made the workout for one player might be a little different than another player based on where their needs are. We have a Monday morning meeting almost every week during the season, if we can, to say, okay, what's our, each player on our team, what's our goal for the week on individual development? We stole from the Spurs what we call vitamins. And so there are pre-practice workouts of a 10 to 20 minute length, either individually or in small groups as part of a player development. So you might have Elena, Emma working with one of the coaches on particular finishes or particular shots that day as part of our pre-practice routine. I put a lot more time into player development things than we do actual up and down practice, 5-on-5, 2-hour practices. Our team practices, when we're all on the court, never go more than about 70 to 90 minutes at most. We do more of our stuff in individual work.
Tremendous insights, Coach. Thanks for that. And a good segue probably too in terms of player development is I've read a quote from you, talks about honesty in coaching and the importance of that. And basically you've said that you're not always going to like what I say, but I'll always tell you the truth. Can you speak to that point a little bit? Because it's so important for coaches to understand the value of honesty for players.
Yeah, I think I've been doing this a long enough time that, you know, you learn from other coaches about the things that work and don't work. And I've always felt, and it comes back to my early mentorship from Coach Wooden, that players aren't always going to like everything you say to them. But I think they know that if you're consistent and you are honest, that you have their best interest at heart. I don't have to be loved by every player, but I do want to be respected for what I can bring them, the things I can do to clarify things for them. And I think all the great players want to be coached because they want to play at the highest level. The issues you have are with players who really don't understand what being great is. And at some point, you really don't want those players on your team if that's not their goal. I think that you can't be high and low, up and down with players if you want them to be kind of rock solid, steady. And so, you know, I try to touch our players every couple of days, even if it's for a few minutes. Just have a simple conversation. How's it going? What's going on? Can, you know, what are you thinking about this? I include our veterans in some of the decision-making process. But that allows you as a coach to go back at them. And when you go at them hard, sometimes they'll understand there's a purpose to that. There's a reason for it. And, you know, that makes for what I call an honest locker room.
Love it. And Coach, you can probably shed some light on this as coaches wind down their seasons a little bit. You're already in this phase. So can you talk a little bit about maximizing your time as a coach once the season ends? What are some things that coaches should focus on that maybe they don't focus on enough in terms of this intermediate period between seasons?
Well, I'll tie part of it to what I also think is important in season. I think so many coaches get wound up in what they're doing. They need to take a mental break, even during the season. I think you have to have days. You know your players need it. And if you know that about your players, the probability is you need it too. So there are times you have to, whether you schedule it or force yourself to do it, you have to turn off the switch a little bit. because I think that's the only way you can re-energize yourself to do the best job for your players. So I think it starts in season. And then when you get to off season, I think you have to, and I'm not great at this, is to have some more downtime. I find, and part of it is because the WNBA off season is so long compared to the NBA. I had for years kind of gotten in that NBA rhythm, you know, 7.5 month season. You got a little bit of time off, but then you're getting ready for the draft, and then it's summer league. And then you got time off about a month. Well, that was fine. But now I have more time to deal with in the off season. I have to figure out better ways to handle it. So I think you need to make sure you have downtime. The second part of it is you have to have an honest reassessment of your season, of your players, of what you did, of your own coaches. What did we do well? What didn't we do well? And really be honest about it. You know, in the off season for my staff, we'll have coming up here in about a month, several day retreat where we sit down and rehash what we went through last year. And obviously winning a championship makes it a little bit more fun exercise, but you know, you have to get better and you got things you got to do. And there's things, you know, you didn't do well. So you have to evaluate that. You have to look and say, what new trends are out there that we're behind on and we don't know? Is there a better way to teach what we're doing? Can we teach it better, more efficiently? Is there a better way to say things to your players to make what you're wanting communicated that much more clear? You know, can you change a phrase that makes it for a young player coming in much easier to understand, and they go, oh yeah, I get it. You know, that picture is in their head. I think you have to make sure you've evaluated every year how your players learn. Everybody learns differently. Some can read a diagram on a sheet and they're fine. Others, that's foreign to them. That doesn't make any sense. But they understand if they see it on film. They're a video game generation. There's others, you have to walk them through it on the court, and it's the only way they'll understand it is by doing it. So I think that's another understanding you kind of have to reassess, because when you're starting next year's practice, you got to say, okay, how are we going to teach at the start, and how are we most quickly and most efficiently going to learn? And I think all of that goes into it. I try every off season to go to one or two NBA training camps or see a team during the season where I can spend a couple of days and see if there's something new. Now, going to the finals didn't allow it this year, so I'm kind of doing it as I go. And then spend time at college practices. You know, we're out looking at players. I like spending more time at practices than I do at games, partly because it's a better job of evaluating. But part of it is you just learn new things. Hey, there's a drill that they get, you know, this team does that's better than the one we have. Try to get the same thing done. And, you know, be willing to steal from somebody else. The best coaches steal constantly from each other. One of our most efficient play sets, we stole from the Portland Trailblazers and Terry Stotts several years ago, and we've just been able to kind of tweak it as we've gone because the spacing in it was so good. That's great. You know, it's a long off-season process, but there's a lot of things you can do to get better.
Tremendous. Great questions that good basketball coaches should ask before the start of the season. So, and to self-evaluate and to go through that process. So it's great stuff. And I'm curious maybe about the practices and the opportunity to go watch practice without being critical, obviously, of anyone. But I'm curious if you have any advice for coaches of saying that these are some things that I see that needs improvement in general when I watch practices, that I don't see enough of this, or I see too much of this, or is there something that stands out to you to help guide us as coaches?
When I'm going out
bit?
To see college practices?
Any practices, to be honest, just generally your impression of practices and what we can improve or what we do too much of or not enough of.
I mean, I'll say the first kind of general term, and I know high school coaches and college coaches will probably argue with me, but I think coaches have this feeling that they're not doing enough if they go shorter. There's so many coaches that it's kind of like this minimum. I'm going to practice 2.5, 3 hours. Well, they should know by now, and every study that's out there showing them about attention span of the players they're coaching these days. Same with film sessions or anything else. I'm a big believer in shorter, more efficient, get our work done practices balanced out with individual work and skill development. I just feel that I go to practices that drag on, and you've lost the players 45 minutes into practice. Because basically players know that every day we come in here, we're going to be here 3 hours, so we're going to pace ourselves. And what you don't get then is high efficiency, high effort in the times that are most important, because players have said, you know, I can only do so much in 3 hours, so here's how I'm going to get through it. But if they knew that practice was 90 minutes or 2 hours or whatever it is, and we're going to go really hard in these four sessions, these 10-minute sessions, you would get a much more efficient practice. The
Coach,
same as film sessions, you know.
Yeah, just to add to that, such a good point, and I want to just emphasize that. Because what I found, too, is that so many coaches are just filling that extra time with fluff anyways. Stuff that doesn't necessarily help.
And they like to hear themselves talk,
game.
Too.
Well, which is the other part. They're not maximizing time on task, active learning time, and all those different things. So I just love that you brought it up.
Yep.
But, let's go into film session then, too, because that's such another part of that.
We have what I'll call is two or three different kinds of film sessions. So we'll have the great power of all the editing you can do now and clips that you can kind of use the time better. So we have individual touch film sessions with an individual assistant coach and one or two players. And they're just looking at themselves or things they need to work on. And then we have team reevaluation sessions. So a day after a game that, you know, you want to spend 10 minutes on yourself. And I try to keep every film session to about 12 minutes or less so that we can keep their attention. It's edited, you know, well, let's say we played last night and we have things that we want to talk about that relates to transition defense or pick and roll defense or offensive spacing, whatever it is. And we'll focus just on a couple of things. I don't think, you know, until maybe playoff time for us that we can have really, really long sessions. And then we'll have our day before game sessions, which are probably 6 to 7 minutes of opposing personnel, 4 or 5 clips. Let our players help talk through some of it. And then we'll take the other team's top 5 plays that we really want to lock in on. And we're going to go out and practice against that day, and we'll show those. And then day of game before shoot around, we'll kind of cover the others we didn't really spend a lot of time on. We're going to walk through some out of bounds plays or whatever. But we try to keep that to, you know, 5-6 minutes. And then the other kind of film we do is positive reinforcement film. We'll take, you know, we've been playing well, or even if you're struggling, go back and find clips of, hey, this is what it looked like when we were playing our best. This is the picture. We want to get that image back in their head of this is how we looked. And, you know, the day before a game or the day of the game, or even sometimes before you take the court that night, a 2-minute, 3-minute clip of, hey, this is the last time we played and this is what we got and we were really good at it, just to kind of put that positive reinforcement back in them as they walk out on the court that day. And I think that's, you know, that's another important way to do it. But none of these films are long at all.
Speaking of film then, what are some things that you specifically look for when you're breaking down film? Maybe some insights that maybe coaches don't pay enough attention to in terms of breaking down film. Are there particular things with all your experience now that really stand out as the most important thing for you to watch?
If I'm breaking down film of our own team, it's starting with, okay, what did we emphasize to our players? All right, so let's pick 3 things that we emphasized going into this game. All right, did we do those well? That's the first thing. When you break down film, you know, you've made a point to your team that, hey, we better be a good blockout team against this in this game, or we need to do a really good job of cutting against their double teams, whatever it is. And so you look at those first. Did we do what we were supposed to do? I'll know probably watching the game live, I'll say to our video guy, hey, I don't have a good feel about how we played pick and roll defense tonight. Give me edits of all of our pick and roll defenses. And that's all I'll watch for, you know, 10, 15 minutes is watch those so I don't get distracted by other things and get sidetracked. I think sometimes, you know, when you're watching film, you're trying to watch everything. And I think it's better to focus sometimes on specific things. Now, I will watch a whole game back and take notes on the game and stop and look at it again. But, you know, I think you have to do both. And then I think the other thing offensively is we'll look at, did we have pace? Did we have spacing? Did we get shots, whether they went in or not, were they acceptable shots for us? Because we try to explain to players, hey, if you miss a shot, you know, I said it earlier, you know, if you miss a shot that you practice every day and was wide open, there are just days you're going to have a bad shooting day or it's not. So if we liked that shot because if it had gone in, we'd all been excited, then we have to like the shot. That's an important thing. When I'm scouting opponents, usually I have a head start in the sense that I, you know, I know what I'm looking for. The edit usually has been broken down for me with the other team's play sets grouped. You know, here's their pick and roll sets. Here's their post up sets. You know, here's their out of bounds plays. So I can kind of go through it. But I also like to scout, and I try to get my assistants to do this, scout the other team's coach. Try to understand that coach and their philosophy as best I can so that, number one, if I put a gun to that coach's head, what are they going to do in crunch time? What do I know about that coach? What do they like to do coming out of timeouts? What's their favorite things at end of games that I can, you know, prepare our team for? Get inside that head. So we're coming out of a timeout with 3 minutes to go. I have a hunch about where this coach is going with personnel, with play sets. So I try to have a feel for the other team and, you know, put myself in that coach's place.
It's great insights again. And coach, I want to use your expertise because you've been through so many different, you've been through coaching or involved in coaching so many different top level players. You can talk a little bit in terms of Elena because she's obviously so special, but what are some things that you can do? Because I think we don't coach the best players hard enough sometimes. But then developing the psyche of your best players got to be a big part of the picture too. What are some ways to be able to balance those two things, to be able to help your best player always be your best player?
Well, one of the things we do, it has to do with just leadership example type things. I mean, I have stressed to my teams for as long as I can remember that we won't be as good as we can possibly be until our best players run the team. That I could walk out the door knowing that we've done our job and you guys put into action what needs to be done. You know your teammates, you know what needs to be done. So I try to, with conversations with our leaders, our best players, get them to think like a coach would. And I'll say to them, Elena, how would you help, you know, Ariel Atkins right now? She's struggling with this. What would you do to make her think about it? Because then she has to think a little bit about what she would do for herself. Second part is, and it's interesting because we had this conversation with Elena when we were working on the trade. Chicago had given us permission to talk to her. And, you know, she's kind of, you know, trying to hear our pitch. And I basically told her the three or four things that I thought she could be better at. And I don't know that anybody had kind of talked to her like that. You know, I said things like, when you were young, I watched you on tape in the eighth grade. And you were a point guard and you made your teammates better. All right. Now you've come to Chicago and everything has been plays to get you a shot. I think your ability should make everybody else better. So let's approach it from that standpoint. What can you do to get Christy Tolliver a better shot or Emma a better shot? You know, coaching them at the defensive end and say, you know, hey, Elena, you're never going to be the fastest player in defense. But what strengths do you have? You have length. You have, you know, anticipation about things. You know how offensive players think. Start translating that to the defensive end of the court. And I think it's kind of a constant challenge. And Elena, every game, sits down with Eric, my son, who's our associate head coach, every single game, before she does a warm-up shooting, for 5 minutes and watches film. Sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's motivational. Sometimes it's, hey, what can I, you know, do in these matchups? But I think you have to challenge them to think like coaches. And I think that's the starting point for me.
Well, it's great because, it creates empathy for her, for you, first of all, because she understands the process you go through a little bit. But then the other part is that it allows her to become a willing participant in not just her development, but the team development as well. So yep. Great stuff.
And I think you get some buy-in with that too. I mean, I have a council of about four veterans that I'll talk to on a regular basis, and I'll let them decide, you know, some travel things or some practice things. And because they know they're allowed to do that, then you can go back to them with other things and they know they've already been included in the process. So they're more willing to take on some other responsibility in that regard.
Yeah, it's great. Make it seem like their idea too, in terms of passing it on to the team and selling it. Yeah, good stuff. Coach, I guess just another curious question I love to ask people at your level is the important stats that you track on the sideline during games. What are the things that are most valuable for you while you're coaching the game to know about?
Wow, it's kind of evolved, changed as we've gone along. We do try to chart play set efficiency on offense. You know, what's working, what's not working. We chart player combinations, plus minuses by groups, what groups are playing well together that night. You know, sometimes as a coach, you feel like so-and-so is not playing that great. And then you look down and then every group she played with, they're a plus. And when she was off the floor, she was a minus. And so it's not the be-all, end-all, but it can be a guide sometimes, particularly about maybe players that should play down the stretch in a particular game. You know, you have faith in certain people, and sometimes I'll ignore it too. I mean, you know, there are nights maybe, you know, Elena or Christie's not having a great shooting game, but you know that they're not afraid of taking a big shot at the end of the game. But I think, you know, that's one of the things. Play set efficiency. There's some other things we chart that I don't look so much at during the game, but we'll come back to our team with, or we'll say it at halftime. You know, we try to chart how many times in a game we get three stops in a row. And generally speaking, if you have six of those occurrences in a game, you probably had a good defensive game. And we don't match that every night that we win. But, you know, I can say, come in at halftime and say, hey, we've only had that happen once in the first half. You know, we're not locked in at this. You know, we'll chart kind of our pick and roll coverages. I'm sure we're charting some other things that I'm not thinking about at the moment. But there's other things we'll chart on film after the game. But I, you know, in the game, I feel like as a coach, I have a pretty good feel, but I want to know, you know, what plays have worked against a team, what matchups or groupings have played well together. Those stick out to me most right now.
Coach, with just your background and all the success and all the experiences you had, do you have any advice to coaches in general in terms of them moving forward with their career or developing their coaching?
I'll start with the most young of coaches, which I was. If you really have a passion for the game, moving up and moving on is not about money. It's not about necessary location and everything else. It's about learning to grind and work and be willing to do everything you can to learn about the game. I mean, I remember being an assistant coach at St. Martin's College, and basically I had to kind of restart my college degree because I wanted to coach so badly that, you know, my college education took a little longer, but I was, you know, not making a lot of money, but I wanted to do it and I wanted the experience that, you know, you have to live through that. I think, you know, that's the first thing. I think the second thing is you have to be who you are, and it takes a while sometimes as the coach to figure out who you are. You're not going to be somebody else. You can admire somebody else. I admired Coach Wooden. I admired a couple of the high school coaches that I was an assistant for, but I just tried to learn from them the things that worked and, you know, sometimes the things that didn't work. My daughter, who's an assistant coach at the University of Minnesota, has coached at a couple of different places, and we talk all the time about, you know, learning something at every stop you make along the way that can help you. And sometimes it's good, sometimes things you wouldn't do. But I think you have to kind of learn to be true to yourself about that. You're not going to be somebody else. You know, I remember watching young coaches when I was young who, you know, Bobby Knight was all the rage. They were going to try to be Bobby Knight. No, you're not going to be Bobby Knight. And not then very few people could get away with what Bobby Knight did. You know, you want to be honest with your players. I think, you know, we talked about that earlier. I think that, you know, you have to be direct. You can't sugarcoat. There are times to sugarcoat some things, but I think that you can't avoid some conflicts at times, because I know coaches complain about all the time, you know, players today, they don't want to confront each other. They don't want to solve problems. They don't want to lead. Well, you got to think, put that in, you know, for your own self too. You know, are you willing to take on tough problems? The job's not easy and it's getting harder. A lot of the game today is psychology, understanding how kids think. Obviously, in college, it's high school. It's dealing with players and AAU coaches, and I mean, parents and peer pressure and all those things. You got to be dialed into that and understand, you know, each generation of kids as they come up, how they think and why they do things. Social media has changed so much of how kids think of themselves and what's important. And if you don't understand that as a coach, you're going to be behind. And so it's a hard business. You got to be willing to pay your dues along the way and maintain the passion. If you're doing, you know, that's you still have to do it at the end of the day because you love the game and you love teaching it. You know, the basketball court is your classroom. You got to like it for being on the court coaching and practice as opposed to the game itself. The game is a byproduct in a sense. All the work gets done way before that game starts.
Great stuff, Coach. Just tremendous knowledge throughout the podcast. So thanks for spending the time with us.
My pleasure, Chris. It's been great.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.